Hello everyone, you're listening to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema, and we're wishing you all a very happy new year. As always, I'm your host Elliot, and if you enjoy what we do here at Celebrating Cinema, you can show your support by leaving us a review on whichever platform you're listening to us on. It really does help other fellow cinema lovers find us. I hope you can all join us for our next film club edition, which will be on the 30th of January, a screening of the cult classic Juice, starring Tupac Shakur. It's a gripping American neo-noir from filmmaker Ernest Dickinson, who you might be familiar with from his work with Spike Lee as cinematographer on films such as Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X. I had the honour of speaking to Ernest, a conversation which we'll be releasing later this month. For me, Ernest is one of the most important Black American filmmakers of the last 40 years. We take a look at his illustrious career, including the iconic collaborations with Spike Lee, the making of the classic Juice, as well as his time working on one of the greatest TV shows of all time, The Wire. You can find link for tickets in the show notes. On this episode, we will be discussing what for me is one of the most essential films of this year, No Other Land.
Thousand Palestinians face one of the single biggest expulsion decisions since the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories began.
This is what's happening in my village now. Soldiers are everywhere.
A raw and unfiltered documentary of one Palestinian village, Masafa Yatta, and their fight to resist the enforced displacement and destruction of their land by Israeli settlers and the Israeli army. Told through the lens of four friends, both Palestinian and Israeli. What we watch is undeniable. They piece together the thousands of fragments of this one crime of ethnic cleansing that the Israeli state has been committing for decades. I got to speak with Basil and Yuval, two of the directors of this film, who you'll hear from shortly. Basil is from Masafa Yatta, and in this conversation, he provides great context to his community's long fight of resistance. Yuval is an Israeli, and he shares his experience of Israeli society's attitudes to such settler violence and the state policies that have enabled it. Let's jump into the conversation. Hi, Basil and Yuval. How are you guys doing today?
I mean, doing fine. Being busy with the movie, screening and interviews.
Normally on this podcast, we always start by asking your first memory of film.
My first memory, I think from being very young at home, we had a very small TV. And I would watch some very... cartoon, like Israeli cartoons, I remember, and Harry Potter, which I really loved when I was young. This is the first film.
I don't know, to be honest, the first film, but...
Speaking about memories, one of the first things we see in the film is your own first memory of this video of you and your father as an activist. Perhaps you could share a bit about the story of your village, Masafa Yatta, and yeah, the history of it.
Yeah, so the village is like Masafa Yatta is like a kind of big space, kind of with 20 small farmers communities that based in this area that adopt on sheep and cultivate land, have olive trees, and this type of life, farmers' life. And in 67, it was like completely like occupied as all the West Bank by the Israeli military. And then by the years, they start to build settlements in our area. That means they squeezed the land. Speaking about today, the vast majority of the land is like controlled by the settlers, and it's like legitimacy. It's the settlers have all the right to build settlements or farms or to cultivate it. Us know, as Palestinians living in this land. Yeah, and I mean, the camera came to Masafa Yatta more than 20 years ago. There was like in 1999, Israel like decided to displace and to make 700 people homeless out of their homes. And in that time, there was like a journalist, activist, that was by chance in that day. in the area, and she got to film some of this footage, which is crazy. The military taking people from their homes and dropping them in a landscape which is considered to be out of Masafa Riyata. And she got some of this footage, and this brought attention of other cameras, other activists, other media to come to cover in this area. We are very far, and this is not usual to have like the people coming and journalists and like photographers come to the area. But because of this specific incident, many of them came. And after that, the people like had temporary decision where they can go and stay in their homes until the final court decision will come. This final decision took 22 years. And during these years, the talking about this area and the documentation and like when I grow up and see the cameras around me, it's something interesting. But also what brought me into this world is I saw that all these past years, I see so much things happening on the ground. The military, for example, come to destroy a home. The settlers commit like attack here and there in my community and other places. I felt nobody know about us. Nobody know that we are existing here. I want the people, the first place, to know about Masafa Riyata, to know that we are existing, that we are human beings living in this area, facing what we face from brutality, and seeking the help and solidarity of the public. And this is the main reason why I started to take a camera and to day-to-day filming what's happening. And by the years, I started to have a kind of, this has become a responsibility, because many people start to know I'm doing it. And all the people calls me about if they have something in their village, come film this, there's something happening here, go film it. This. My main thing to do in my life for years, it was this. I wake up, I don't know what to do until something happens in the area. So I take the camera and run to do it. So the crazy thing is I can't like plan my life. I just wake up, and even if I plan something and something else happens, so it's canceled, I go. And this happened to us in the movie. We are so many times, for example, editing, sit to edit, because we do the editing in my home. It's the only place we can, the four of us as a filmmakers, meet and do the work. A lot of time we sit to edit, for example, a scene of home demolition, and then a real home demolition is happening. So I have to shut everything and to take the cameras and run to the field to film that.
You feel that in the film as well, because there are these sort of slower moments of you two just living, or just these quieter moments, and then it's completely jarring to see you running with the camera. But maybe we can start a bit about what took you to Masafa Riyata, Yuval, and how your friendship started, but also why that was a focus of the film itself.
Yeah, so me and Basil met 5 years. We met through a common activist friend. Masafa Riyata as a community is a place where there are activists who are coming there all the time, people who are opposing the occupation and who come to do solidarity work and to document, to write, to protest. And there are Israeli activists like me, and international ones as well. Also Dutch people who come. And it's a very unique community in that sense, in the way that it has, it invites people who share the same values to join in the fight for the community's survival. And I came there with Rachel Shore, who's also an Israeli journalist, and we met Basil and Hamdan Balal, who is a photographer from the area. And yeah, after, you know, working together and documenting and writing together, mainly things on social media that received very little attention, we felt that this is too important and the world is not paying attention. This was 5 years ago. And we decided, Hamdan had an idea, why don't we make a film? And, you know, and we decided to try. For me personally, what brought me there is a sense of responsibility. After learning Arabic, I began to speak with Palestinians, not to understand, you know, who they are through the Israeli media, which is, you know, often kind of like, I think, demonizing their voices, and just going on the ground and seeing for myself. I was very shocked, like, about what I saw in the occupied West Bank, and about, you know, I remember when I first met Basil, there was a demolition. I saw the soldiers basically, you know, throwing stun grenades and using so much violence just to destroy a Palestinian sheep shelter, I think it was the first time. And later on, it was, you know, a Palestinian house and a school. And I was asking myself, why is one of the world's strongest militaries destroying a school? What's going on here? And when you look at it, and I investigated it as a journalist, you open the state archive, you begin to see why these policies are happening, and it becomes, you know, evident very quickly that this is a way to take over the land and to prevent the Palestinian state, to basically stop the two-state solution, which I think the Israeli state has been trying very hard for many decades to stop. And I am opposed to it because I am responsible for it, and because I think if you are hurting the Palestinians, you are hurting the Israelis, because I think we are connected in a way. I think, you know, we cannot be secure if the Palestinians are not free. And for me, this was something that motivated me. And yes, you mentioned our talks. I mean, it was important for us to show our characters in the film to also as a way to show the power imbalance that exists between us. You know, me being under civilian law, and Basil under military law. I don't know if a lot of people understand what this means, but we're living under the same state, essentially. Yet under two different systems of law. So the laws that rule my life, I can influence, I can vote. They are very lenient laws that respect my human rights, generally. Basel, like millions of Palestinians, cannot vote. So imagine that a foreign military that comes here to Amsterdam and tells you, like, you know, your house is now illegal, you cannot have water, you cannot have electricity, speaks in a foreign language, speaks in Chinese, or I don't know, some other foreign, and you don't understand anything. And they just use force to determine the laws that control you. So it's wrong. And we wanted, through showing our characters in the film and showing it in a very, the film is a very intimate film. It's a very human film. We're showing it, you know, we are friends, but we are showing that, you know, we are deeply, deeply unequal. And this is something that hunts, you know, our ability to work together and to do what we are doing, which for us is a form of core resistance. You know, it's a form of, it's an expression of our shared values, our belief in a different future, and our opposition to the occupation, and therefore I think it was important for us to be critical of ourselves as well, and to reflect on the work that we are doing, to ask ourselves the questions, to examine, you know, what we are doing and what is happening to the Masafriata community, which it's still happening. You know, it's not over, it's ongoing. And I think if there is no dramatic change in the way in which the international community is not placing any pressure to end the occupation, any pressure on the Israeli state, the community of Basel might not exist after 4 years of a Trump presidency. So I think it's extremely urgent.
And you spoke a bit about how this decision to make it a film, and you see in the film itself, you guys sort of, let's say, struggling with the articles you're writing because they aren't reaching the kind of audience that you hope it would. What do you think it is about a film or cinema that's able to now reach so many people, and also the power of the camera as your weapon of fighting back or resisting?
Yeah, I mean, in our situation, the camera is almost the only tool to confront the what's happening, and especially in the situations like ours, where we need, like, it's important to have evidence. It's very important always to have evidence of what's happening. It's also not just to show the people, which is extremely important, but also in front of this military courts that, you know, simply a settler can come and attack you and then just claim that you, like, a Palestinian attacked him, you know, just like this lie might, like, this get the soldiers to arrest the Palestinian. This happened to my father, this happened to so many people in the community. And if you are, and the only way to get out of this situation is to have a video of evidence, because if you bring one Palestinian, 10 Palestinians as eyewitnesses in front of Israeli military court, our words has, like, never be believed unless there is a video, a footage that they can say nothing about it. Yeah, I mean, for some time also we've been using, for me personally, using social media and trying to have way, like, different ways to publish what I filmed, this footage, for the public, for the people to see. I didn't think about, like, a documentary about a movie in the past when I was filming. But using social media mainly, and then Yuval was doing the articles, and then we become also write articles together. But then with Hamdan, with Rachel together, we start working in this documentary. We wanted another way to reach different audience, wider numbers of audience, to bring this, like, issue to them. Also, the documentary is showing all this political issue which is for a normal audience to be complicated and not understandable. And we wanted our goal like to be able to understand this, because this is like they can read the article about settlers' violence, article about a home demolition, see a video of another incident, but not to connect those things together. But in the movie, we wanted to show the whole issue, that it's about the land, it's about the communities that the Israel want to whip them out from the ground and to build the settlements, and using these weapons, the law, the settlers' attacks, the demolitions, all these scenes that people see in the documentary. And I think we succeeded. I think this is a good movie for people to learn who doesn't know about what's happening, or like they don't really understand what's going on. This is like, I think this movie really teach them and giving them a sense of this, like, decades of the occupation and how it's hurting us as Palestinians living in this land.
Could you talking about connections, how what we watch in this film, No Other Land, how this is also a form of ethnic cleansing, and how this slow build-up over time, which we later learn out is an Israeli state policy, is very much connected to the much more graphic images that we see every day now coming from Palestine and Gaza.
So just to give a like small statistic about Gaza, for example, now a third of the Gaza Strip's land is under Israeli military control. They're like military, it's been raised completely and it's under full, their military establishments. There's a 1 kilometer long buffer zone that the military created all around the perimeter of Gaza. There is a very wide 7 kilometer corridor called the Netzarim Corridor. There is the Philadelphia Corridor. There are 14 raid routes into Gaza. And if you speak to Israeli soldiers, or you look at satellite imagery and you see what is being built there, there are facilities being built there for a permanent, what seems to be a permanent Israeli military presence, a permanent occupation of the north of Gaza, which is, if you think about it, quite similar to what Israel did in Masafer Yatta in the 1980s, where it declared or it created a military excuse to control the land. I mean, as Basil said, all of his community was declared a military training zone. And that was a tool to push Palestinians out of the land and to establish or to facilitate the establishment of settlements. And it is now likely, likelier, unfortunately, that we will see in this twisted way, we will see Israeli settlers entering Gaza, then we will see Israeli hostages leaving Gaza. It's like, it's a very fucked up situation where, you know, basically the 95% of the Gaza's population was uprooted, ethnically cleansed from the north in a very short period of time. Whereas in Masafer Yatta, the policies in the West Bank have been spread around over longer periods of time. And in a way, I think a power of our film is that we are taking decades and decades of this and squeezing it into an hour and a half. I think a main goal of this policy was to prevent it from becoming a story. Because when you do something slowly, you know, and there are many cases of this in the world. It's not only Israel-Palestine. I mean, there are other cases where states, in order to avoid accountability, instead of, you know, committing a crime at once, they break it to 1,000 pieces. And then the crime is not seen. And in a way, we as, you know, storytellers, we are connecting those 1,000 different little pieces to tell a story, to show the policy, to show the ethnic cleansing, to show the war crime that is happening there. And that's in a way part of the political importance. And there's also another strength to making a film. You know, it's not just about the facts. It's that are the dry facts on the ground. It's also about what it means for human beings. What, you know, you can learn a lot about the occupation by reading, you know, a report by Amnesty International. But our film is not a human rights report. I mean, you learn much more about the emotional truth of living this kind of life, of going to sleep, and you don't know if your house will be destroyed in the morning, of looking at your son who was shot and he's sitting paralyzed in a cave, and you know that there can be no accountability for the shooter because you are living under a system that is against you, that will not provide you with security and safety and accountability because you don't have your own state. You're being controlled by a foreign military. And this human face to the occupation is very important, and it often gets overlooked and missed in articles. And
has this film been screened in Israel?
It hasn't been yet. Our plan in January is to make it available online, both in Israel and in Palestine, to make it basically geo-blocked and available to the people there. People don't go to the cinemas that much anyway, so we will choose a platform that respects our values, that is politically aligned with our beliefs, and we will make it accessible in January. It is being released, I mean, in the next few months, pretty much all over the world. The only place where we have trouble is the US. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Out of interest, what were Israeli reactions before when they'd see settler violence, let's say before October 7th?
So in Israeli society, if it's just looking at settler violence, you will hear parts of the society, even I would not say a minority, there are, you know, substantial parts of the society who will condemn it. The problem is that they view settler violence in an isolated way. So it is viewed, as many in the West view it, as something that happens because of a few bad apples, you know, like a few extremist settlers that are there. And that's obviously false, because settler violence can only happen because the military is enabling it, is participating in it, is arming the settlers, is protecting their illegal outposts, is coming with them to attack the Palestinians and either participating or just protecting them, the settlers. The Israeli police is not investigating those settlers. So there's an entire system around those acts of settler violence that allow it to continue, and it's much easier for the Israeli society to speak about settler violence as something isolated than it is to speak about the system of military occupation that's in place in the West Bank, and that you will find much fewer people today, politically nobody in the Israeli Jewish parliament members talking about, unfortunately.
And what I did find striking, actually, is you spoke about how activists are always welcome in Masaf Yatta, but for you, Yuval, as an Israeli, I felt you were welcomed in such a way where there was a recognition of what your country was doing, but it wasn't taken out on you as an individual, and they were willing to talk to you and hear you, and because you were there turning up every day, there was a sense that they saw you as an equal or someone willing to fight with them.
I really identify with that. And I think it's something that the global left should also learn from in a way, because I think at the end of the day, what should matter is what people support, what their values are. And honestly, the most important thing is how it can influence reality, you know, like, at the end of the day, okay, like the nationality of an individual matters, what the individual say matters, but the key question is how do we shift power imbalance in a way that can protect people when hundreds of thousands of people are being killed in Gaza or in the West Bank, or like that's the key issue. Therefore, if there are people who share the same values and who can help, I think for me it makes sense that they are welcome. Of course, there is a lot of tension because, as people tell me, you know, like I'm part of the society that is committing these crimes, but also, that's, you know, that gives me also power and responsibility to change it.
And for you, Basil, what was clear in the film as well, we spoke a bit about how there is a lot of archive footage of the past, but there's a real connection between the past and the present. More of your family and your community's sort of history of ongoing activism and resistance, and how I felt there's like over time there's a shift of responsibility of you as a child and other children around you knowing that it's also up to you to take over what your fathers and your grandfathers have been fighting for.
Yeah, exactly. So the movie is showing, like, we want to show the generations of the occupation existing since decades, and we're living this like miserable life day to day since decades, and we're born and raised under the same almost conditions, under the same routine, under the same like miserable situation. So yeah, people want to choose to, like, my family, specifically my parents, like, choose to challenge and choose to try to find a way to challenge and to confront the occupation. One of it was the camera, but also on the ground, more like to be activists, like on the land and building in the community.
I love the story of your mother and deciding that the children and women should build the school in the day and the fathers come in the evening.
So this part of this kind of activism they've been involved in, like, peaceful protests and like try to build, and they succeed to build the school, the clinic in the community, with the community for sure. the electricity for our small village. And like, even though the occupation keep like destroying things, the community insist to rebuild, and to, because at the end of the day, the people want to find the minimum life in these conditions. So anything that they can do, they would do it, because they're doing it for themselves and to keep like steadfastness on their land and to feel some strength in front of these occupiers.
I wanted to ask you guys a bit about the role of cultural institutions, because while we can all agree that a ceasefire is needed immediately, we do see places like UN, ICJ recognize that it is illegal, this Israeli occupation, that it is a genocide, it is ethnic cleansing. But then film festivals, they have yet to adopt the language of these other political institutions, and why it's important that not only screening your film matters, but for them to have the same language in why they're screening your films.
I mean, everybody today looking at the crazy situation, especially in Gaza, like even us, like who lives in the West Bank, and like being under these conditions, are really like our hearts and thoughts are with the people in Gaza and with this like unbelievable conditions and the day-to-day crimes, and like so many people is being killed every day, Gaza and Lebanon as well, with this like bombardment policy, which is crazy. I think people that think of themselves that they are like pro human rights and pro democracy, and they have the and they respect the international law, today there's no any excuse that they would be silent and not calling for a ceasefire and not calling Israelis like committing very clear crimes and violating the international law. This is like, it's very clear for everybody, and everybody who believes in these values and who's like refusing the violence and the killings should be very clear in their statements that they're supporting the stop of killing of people and accountability for the war criminals that they're like committing crimes, violating the international law in every day, in every moment, actually, what's happening. The ICJ ruled very clearly about Israelis like occupying the West Bank, Jerusalem, Gaza illegally, and must end, and they should leave this land. But yet, as you said, the hypocrisy of the governments and in the West, and the complicity with Israel in these crimes are very crazy, and it's hurting us. And it's crazy when their policies influence in festivals and influence on the mainstream media in the West. We as a Palestinian very much hurt by these policies since long time, and this is why we are here. This is why we show our movie to the Dutch people, to the Germans, to the French people, and everywhere we go. More important for us, the people on the street. They should see what their governments are complicit with the crimes. Not any crimes. It's killing like tens of thousands of people and erasing people and ethnic cleansing the Palestinians from their land. And this is like actions where international law be very clear violated. But yet, as you said, those governments are keep supporting Israel, like military and business and diplomats' covers when it tries to face accountability by the international law, they prevent it.
I think your film is a testament of how it's been able to transcend political borders and national borders, the fact that regardless of what people's opinions are, it's still being screened worldwide and recognized. Usually on this podcast, we normally close by asking, what are your hopes for the future? Personally, I think it's a bit of an unfair question to ask both of you right now. And if I could try answer it for you, perhaps, I would say that this film is a symbol of hope itself. I think it's a testament that you yourself, Basil, from a small village of Masafayata, have been able to travel the world with this film and share your story. And I think it shows the power of stories. And I hope that people watching this film aren't just moved by it, but they are, like you say, in the film itself, compelled to find ways to create change.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found this conversation as powerful as I have. If you haven't already seen No Other Land, then I urge you to go and watch it. You can find a link for tickets in the show notes. It will be screening here at Lab 111. I would also like to draw your attention to a conversation we'll be releasing in the coming weeks with Haitian filmmaker Raoul Peck around his latest film, Ernest Cole, Lost and Found, which will be in cinemas from the 16th of January. This is about one of the first photographers of apartheid in South Africa. Immediate parallels which can be drawn to the conversation we had today. So stay tuned for that. Make sure to get your tickets for the Film Club edition of Juice. Links for that will be in the show notes. As always, you can show your support by leaving us a review. This was Celebrating Cinema, a Lab 111 production, edited by myself, Elliot Bloom, music from Hugo Amezal, and artwork by Studio FFF.